It takes a village to raise a child. We all know that, right? But what happens if you can't find your village? Because raising your child is really, really tough. What if you were so filled with shame and doubt and guilt and fear of judgment that you don't share your triumphs and your struggles? You don't talk about it because you don't think anyone can possibly relate. Well, I've been there, and it was really hard for me to find my tribe. So I decided to make mine. I went out and found these amazing mothers who are also in the trenches, struggling to raise their kids. Together, we are a community. And in this podcast, On the Hard Days, you'll find motivating stories from other real moms who get it. We're going to accept who we are and how we show up for our children each and every day, even on the hard days. Welcome back, everyone. I am so excited to have Hannah Mira here today. And Hannah, we were just talking about our pets because you have cute dogs behind you. And you said that you're big into rescue organization stuff. And I would love to hear more about that, too. But why don't you first just start off by sharing a little bit about you and your family?
Yes. Yeah, so I currently live in Orange County, California. I was born and raised here. I met my husband when I was living in the Bay Area. I went up there after graduate school to work as a teacher, and I taught up there for 8 years, had my son up there. He'll be 5 in May. And then we relocated to Orange County literally the week COVID started, like March of 2020. We ended up coming back down to Orange County, and we have been here ever since. My husband is pretty neurotypical. I actually have autism and ADHD. And my son is neurodivergent, but we don't know exactly what sort of diagnosis he falls under as of yet.
Mm-hmm. What were those early signs like with your son in terms of like recognizing, oh, you know, he might be neurodivergent?
Yeah. So one of our biggest things that we noticed was a lot of just generalized dysregulation. We noticed he just seemed to be off, you know, being, he was being put off by things that a lot of kids didn't seem to be phased by. So he had a lot of, you know, specificities that needed to be met. And, you know, as someone who's also neurodivergent, I understand that those specificities aren't sort of, you know, oh, well, he's just picky. It's not about picky. It's about needing a certain set of sensory inputs in order to feel balanced. And he started to display this around like 15 months, I would say, was when I started to be like, okay, this just seems off. And I remember at the time we had a horrible insurance provider. I won't say their name, but it rhymes with Schmeiser. And I was like, hey, I think something's really, you know, like something is not right. He's also not speaking. You know, I had all these concerns, and it was just kind of like, oh, just anxious mom stuff, you know? And it wasn't taken seriously. I remember his pediatrician actually telling me all blonde boys talk later. And I was like, that sounds terribly unpediatrician.
What?
I know, right? Yeah. So between that and like my concerns about the dysregulation and the fact that he just seemed so unhappy and frustrated in his own body, and I couldn't help him, you know? And I was a first time mom. So that was really challenging, just dealing with that sort of sense of overall dysregulation and the lack of ability to communicate verbally. Those were the first signs that we noticed.
Hey guys, I have some very exciting news to share with you. But before I do, I want to ask you a couple of questions. Okay, here we go. How many of the following statements that I'm about to say resonate with you? You're raising a neurodivergent child. You don't know many people raising a child like yours, if any, and you feel a sense of isolation and loneliness. You don't have anyone to vent to who understands what you're going through, with maybe the exception of immediate family, but even in that case, it's just different. Your day-to-day life is really hard. You're chronically exhausted. You're overwhelmed by your child's needs and whether or not you can provide them. You're emotionally drained from long meltdowns and walking on eggshells all the time. And all of the thoughts and feelings that you have fester inside because you're afraid that whoever you share them to will judge not only you, but your child too. You're struggling mentally because you don't know anyone living a similar life, so you blame yourself for your child's challenges. You find yourself often fighting off guilt, shame, and doubt in your mothering skills, but those feelings just keep bubbling up to the surface. You're going through the grieving process, and, you know, my goodness, it's been weeks, months, years, and you're still in it. Because truth be told, this isn't what you signed up for. You don't know what your child's future holds, and frankly, you're terrified. You love your child beyond words, and you'd give anything for their happiness and well-being. But sometimes you feel like you're the only one celebrating those little wins that honestly mean so much. Okay, so I could go on and on and on. I get it. And so many of you guys know, you know, I've been there. I struggled with the challenging behaviors and complicated diagnoses of my child. But more than that, I struggled with my sense of self-worth. I was meant to be a mom, or so I thought, for a while. But I felt like everyone around me knew the secret to raising a happy child, and I just missed the memo. Only bad moms had struggling children, and I truly thought I was to blame. If only I had one mom just like me, raising a child just like mine, in my life. If only I could have said to her, I feel like this is my fault, and I wasn't meant to be my kid's mom, only to have her say right back, I can't believe you just said that, I feel the exact same way. So, I mean, like, how could both of us feel that way and have it be true? It's not true. But I didn't know that for a long time. So it took many years, but finally, I cracked the code on how to feel better as a mom of a neurodivergent child. And to put it simply, it's community. But not just any community. Facebook groups absolutely do not count. I mean deep connections and real friendships and a safe, judgment-free place. And I know that this sounds like a unicorn. I promise you it's not. It exists in Mothers Together. And that's why I'm launching our very first ever Mothers Together open house. It's going to be a free 5-day challenge that will leave you with at least one strong connection to another mom just like you. You'll walk away after day 5 feeling, for the first time, true validation from another mom who gets it. It's like a mini Mothers Together. I want you to experience what all of us experience in this community. And it's validation, because you deserve to know what it feels like to be validated, because you deserve to feel good. So to participate in this free open house, which is going to happen in mid-August, I want you to go right now to this link where you're going to put in your email. That's it, just your email, and then I will send you out more information over the next couple of weeks. So that website is mothers-together.com/open house. And I will put that link in the show notes of this episode so that you can see it and click on it there as well. All you got to do is sign up. It's completely free. I'm going to be in there. I'm going to introduce you to other moms. I'm going to make those connections for you. And I am so excited about it. I can't wait for you to experience this. So if you feel like you are ready to find out what Mothers Together is all about and actually give it a try, then I'm inviting you to our home. Because Mothers Together is a home. It is a warm and welcoming space, and I want you to know what it feels like to walk through the front door and have moms say to you, I'm so happy to see you. I know that the bags you've been carrying are so heavy, but we're here to take them off your hands. All right, guys, sign up for the Mothers Together open house, and I can't wait to see you there. You mentioned before that you being neurodivergent yourself, it's sort of like you immediately were like, oh, you know, you just require sensory input in a certain way. And do you feel like that gave you a better chance at understanding your kid based on what you have been through?
Yes and no, because at the time when he was experiencing it, it never crossed my mind that he was neurodivergent. Like, for some reason, it just didn't occur to me, you know. And now I'm currently finishing up a master's in social work, so I have a lot more sort of understanding now about, you know, the hereditary nature of neurodivergence. And it's like, well, if I have autism and ADHD, chances are my son is probably going to be neurodivergent as well. And there's a lot of literature that kind of, you know, shows that there is some hereditary components to that. So for Nick, I just, in the beginning, I didn't really think like, oh, this must be a neurodivergence thing. I was like, is he ill? Like, what is going on? So it took me a while to get the understanding of like, oh, what he's doing is kind of like what I do when I feel my sensory needs aren't being met. You know, we call them, our family calls them sensory ick. You know, if I have a sensory ick, like my cuff is wet or something, I can't ignore that my cuff is wet. Everything stops until I can change my shirt. Like that's sort of the level that sensory stuff can get in the way of an adult or a child functioning. And they're not trying to be, you know, naughty or disobedient. They're just, they can't move past it until you help them. And that's the place that I had to get to in my brain, where my child, he's not trying to push back or be, you know, uncooperative. He is literally trying to feel okay in his own body.
Yeah, that makes so much sense. And I feel like you have to get to a place where you understand yourself first. And some parents, I would say myself included, and my husband as well, like we're still very much learning about ourselves right now. And yeah. So there are times when I go, oh, okay, that's why my kid acted like that. But I feel like it would have been nice if I had already really understood myself a few years ago, and maybe the whole process of accepting and understanding and helping my kid would have gone better. So do you feel like you had a really good understanding of yourself early on, or are you still in the learning phase?
Oh, very much in the learning phase. Like I got my ADHD diagnosis when I was a teenager, but a lot of things just still didn't make sense to me. And I was like, well, why do I do this? Like, this doesn't align with what I know ADHD to be. And I didn't get my autism diagnosis until this year. Like I'm almost 40. Like that's how long it took before I like begin to think, hey, everything that I'm noticing in myself lines up with autism. And then I began doing research about how underdiagnosed women are when it comes to being autistic, you know, and it's often, you know, oh, generalized anxiety. Oh, you're just highly sensitive. Oh, this. And it's frightening, because once you have this understanding of how your brain works, you get this sort of like, oh my gosh, well, that makes sense. And you go through a period of acceptance and, you know, grieving the fact that your childhood may have been a little more difficult because you didn't have this understanding and you didn't have the support that comes with diagnosis, you know? So I'm still very much figuring out what it means to be, you know, a very neurodivergent adult. I'm day by day, I'm figuring it out. Yeah.
Yeah. Wow. Wow. So it's so interesting. And you said generalized anxiety and highly sensitive. And I'm like, yep, it's me. And you go to, I don't know if you're active on TikTok, but I like to watch TikToks, and like, there's this whole neurodivergent TikTok movement, and there's autistic TikTok and ADHD TikTok. And it's like, wow, a lot of these things check the boxes. But I wonder, again, back to understanding myself, is this going to help me understand my kid better, or am I going to be in denial of me, in denial of him? And I guess it's a different process for everybody, but did you feel like you just sort of jumped right into full acceptance, or did you have any question marks in there as you went along?
In terms of my own diagnosis or in terms
I guess I would say both, you and your kid.
Yeah. So for Nick, so Nick's journey is a very long one. You know, we understand that he is neurodivergent just based on his behavior. You know, from my unofficial assessment of him, his behavior seemed to align more with ADHD, as opposed to, autism. But I feel like I'm still in the process of kind of unpacking and understanding him, and unpacking and understanding myself.
Yeah. So with that being said, what do you find right now is like your toughest challenge in this motherhood journey that you are on? And maybe it's more about you, maybe it's more about your son, but what are you struggling with mostly right now?
I think one of the biggest challenges for parenting right now is advocating and bringing awareness to, you know, neurodivergence as an invisible disability, which is for a lot of kiddos and adults is what it is. You know, people tend to have an idea of what neurodivergence looks like in a very binary sense. It's this or it's that, but it's spectral, as, you know, most people who are neurodivergent would agree. And so I think for, you know, myself and my son, you know, we both present as, you know, on the lower needs end of the spectrum in certain capacities. And that can be challenging because when my son has a behavior or does something that shows me like, hey, he's really dysregulated, what sensory needs are out of whack for him right now, I have to take a step away from caring about what other people think and are other people judging or are other people like, you know, oh, look at that terrible mother, her childhood, you know, like I have to disconnect from that. And that is challenging because I think as mothers, we're sort of, you know, unconsciously wired to care what everyone thinks, has, you know, everyone's input about our parenting, which we shouldn't, but we do because that's how we are. So I think that's one of the biggest challenges for me is being like, I don't care what anyone else says. I have to take care of my son's needs, even if it's embarrassing or, you know, inconvenient or something along those lines.
Mm-hmm. That's really hard to do. What's an example of like a situation that could occur where you have learned how to do that, how to advocate in that way?
I think so for our kiddo, one of the biggest challenges for him is transitions, which is pretty, you know, common for a lot of kiddos going from a preferred to a non-preferred activity. So Nick is still taking speech and he loves speech to the point where he doesn't want to leave speech because the toys are so fun and they're so new. So when it's like, okay, speech is done and we have to go, there can be a lot of pushback and a lot of refusal. And something that is, you know, as easy as walking out of a room is not that easy for him. So for us, that could look like, you know, we need a couple minutes before speech ends to be like, okay, speech is going to end. Give him the countdown, give him options. So he feels some sort of control over the situation. Like, do you want to, you know, jump out of the room? Do you want me to carry you out of the room? Like try to put some sort of a playful spin on it and acknowledge that, you know, I totally get that you don't want to leave speech right now. You're having so much fun with the trains, you know, but, you know, speech teacher has a new friend coming in. So like acknowledging the feelings, but also working towards, this is something you have to do. We have to leave the room. So that's a big challenge for us right now is those transitions. And that's something mm-hmm. that we're constantly working on.
Mm-hmm. Same here. In that example, did you find success with that? Like, how did your son react to those things? I often find my son would say, you know, when I, things like, do you want to jump out of the room or crawl or whatever? And he'd feel patronized, but maybe mm-hmm. that's my kid. He's very like, I'm like happy sing song voice. And he's like, no, this is terrible. I don't want to leave, you know? So how do you handle that sort of thing as well?
Well, yeah. So my little guy is 4. So he's a little more like, trickable, I guess you could say. Yeah. But no, he'll definitely dig his feet in and be like, no, I just want 2 more minutes to play with it. And I bet we don't have those 2 minutes, unfortunately. And again, as you've mentioned, there are those hard days when I know it's going to be more of a battle. Like I can just sense it. Like you wake up in the morning, the energy is off, the vibe, the juju, everything is off. And you're like, this is going to be one of those days. I can just feel everything's just going to take longer and be harder. And on those days, sometimes I've had to just pick him up and be like, well, we're leaving now, you know, which I can't do for much longer because, you know, he's a 50-pound 4-year-old. So yeah, on times like that, I just sometimes have to do what I have to do, even if it goes against kind of all the things I know I'm supposed to do. Like I'm supposed to gentle parent right now and talk you through it, but I don't have the luxury of time, you know, like there are, there's appointments. And so I think you're constantly kind of holding this space of cognitive dissonance in your brain where like, I know what gentle parenting is. I know what I'm supposed to do, but I can't right now just because of the facts of the situation. I think that's something that I struggle with.
Mm-hmm. You know, it doesn't sound, I believe that you struggle with it, but it doesn't sound like you do. It sounds, I love hearing your confidence and just the way that you it seems like you're just very like, this is what he needs and this is what I'm going to do. And black and white in a, the best way possible. I feel
that's
like
autism. Yes. That's a black and white. very like this. Yeah.
Yeah. But I love that because it's, there's no question in your mind. You're like, this is what I'm going to do. I find myself constantly thinking and overthinking, mm-hmm. you know, maybe I should have reacted that way. And if I had said this thing and if I had done this and so how do you approach the day-to-day life parenting your son, knowing that you are the best mom for him and that, you know, without questioning yourself?
I don't know how I don't question it. I just know that we are matched together for whatever reason and it works, but there are a million times every day when I'm like, I could have handled that differently. And that's where I have to kind of engage in like the self-talk. Thank you, therapy. I have to kind of engage in that self-talk and be like, okay, what did you do that you weren't okay with? And does it require a repair? And if it does, then that is me sitting down with my son and being like, hey, earlier today, I got kind of irritated with you and I used, you know, a cranky voice and that wasn't okay. And I'm sorry. And usually he's forgot about it. He's like, what? And I'm like, I want to repair because I think it's not about being a perfect parent, but it's about being a reflective parent. And that's something that I try to do with my kid is understanding that I'm going to mess up a billion times. But if I can apologize for at least some of those mess ups, then hopefully I can offset, you know, some of the things he's going to tell his future therapist about me.
I love that you said it's not about being a good parent. It's about being a reflective parent. And so true. So very true. A lot of moms that I have talked to often struggle where they feel like they are reflective, but maybe their partners or spouses are not, or family, extended family is not. That can be pretty tough. Is that something that you've ever dealt with before?
It's something that I definitely had to kind of work on with my husband. My husband comes from a home and as he has shared, there wasn't a whole lot of apologizing if parents did something that wasn't wrong, or that was, you know, wrong, you know. So for him, he kind of had to learn what it meant to parent just sort of, you know, from scratch, so to speak. So for him, that looked like going to therapy. You know, I'm a huge, huge, huge proponent of therapy. I love therapy. I think everyone should go to therapy. But for him, that looked like going to therapy. And that looked like figuring out, how do I parent in a way that is conducive with my values? How do I separate that from what I know wasn't helpful for me as a child? And I have to do the same thing. I have to separate from what wasn't helpful for me when I was little and take the good things that we can take from, you know, our parents or our caretakers. So for both of us, the process looks a lot like conversation. My husband will look at me and be like, what do I do in this situation? If he doesn't know, if he's finding himself triggered, he'll be like, I need to step away. Can you sort of tap in here for me? And I'll do the same thing where I will be like, you know, hey, you know, I'm getting really triggered right now. Can you please step in here? You know, child's having a meltdown and I can leave. So to me, you know, for us, it looks like therapy. It looks like communication. And it looks again, like repairing, whether we're snapping at each other or we're snapping at our kid, it looks like always going back and owning your piece and trying to, you're always going to make mistakes, but just not make the same mistake.
Yep. Well said. You mentioned therapy and I agree with you. A lot of moms are hesitant. A lot of dads are very hesitant. What has your therapy journey been like for you?
Yeah. So my therapy journey has been very similar to, you know, Frodo's journey to return the ring. You know, it's, my parents put me in therapy when I was a teenager, cause I was acting out at school, you know, the ADHD, getting in trouble, just, you know, very, very, you know, all over the place. And again, undiagnosed autism. So I didn't have a positive experience as a teen. So when I turned 18, I was like, no therapy, you know. And then when I moved up to the Bay Area, I didn't know one person there. I went up there for work. And so I was very lonely. I started to struggle with a lot of anxiety and intrusive thoughts and like stuff where I was just like, I don't feel well in my own mind, you know? So I ended up going to a fabulous therapist who I really, really liked. And he was a game changer for me. And then I ended up seeing another therapist who does EMDR. And EMDR was a game changer. I can't recommend that enough if there's any kind of like trauma or, you know, something that you want to, you know, process. So those were all really beneficial. And then when we moved back down here, we found an amazing therapist that my husband and I both go to, who we absolutely love. And she takes insurance, which is just like, you know, getting those two things together is amazing. So overall, it's been good. I do have to share. I met this one woman in the Bay Area. I won't use her name. I went to see her one time. And she was using a room in like this house. It was like an old kind of Victorian house. And all of the rooms have been turned into different offices. So everyone was occupying a different room in the house. And I walked into the office and she's got, you know, the two chairs and everything. And there is a whole like metal pen full of dogs, probably like 8 or 9, all small dogs. And I was like, oh, you know, I like dogs. Like, oh, is your dog? She goes, oh, no, I also do dog sitting on the side. So, you know, throughout our meeting, there's dogs like barking and like pooping and like,
oh,
you
my know, God.
Yipping. And it gets better. People are coming to pick up their dogs during the session. So like people are knocking on the door like every 15 minutes, because my appointment was at like 5 o'clock end of the day. People were coming in, like talking with her, picking up their dog and leaving. And I was like, am I on a candid camera? Like what is going on here? Then like at one point there was a lady picking up her dog, another lady at the door, the UPS guy comes in to deliver packages. And I was just like,
oh my gosh.
So that was funny, but I think, yeah, in terms of therapy, finding a good person, it can be tricky.
Wow. Oh my gosh. That's both hilarious and super frustrating. I mean, you are a dog lover, right?
Yeah. But yeah,
maybe not in that capacity when you're trying to.
Yeah, I know. Yeah, exactly. Like the woman that I saw who did EMDR, you know, she had a dog in her, you know, place as well. And I loved it, but you know, running a dog sitting / psychiatry business is an odd pairing. You don't
totally. So can you talk a little bit about EMDR for those who don't know what it is, or how that kind of therapy would benefit an adult?
Yeah. So EMDR, I was the acronym mixed up, is eye movement desensitization reprocessing. So basically it involves some kind of a bilateral stimulation. The way that my therapist did it was I would have like a buzzer in each hand, and the buzzers would make this sort of like alternating sort of vibrational impulse in each hand. And this triggers both sides of your brain to work at the same time. And as you're doing this, your therapist basically walks you through a traumatic event that you said that you want to revisit. And so you are revisiting this event in the safety of a therapist's office while you are triggering both sides of your brain. In essence, it sort of helps you to push through the blockage of a trauma that's been sitting there. I think of it as like, if you have a clog in a pipe, you know, like you put the Drano down and it pushes that's sort of what it does. When I had come to start seeing my therapist, my son was one. I had a super traumatic birth with him. It took me like weeks to actually like bond with him. I remember just, you know, looking at him like, oh God, I have to keep this thing alive. You know, like, you know, so I didn't have the traditional like mom sort of joy experience. And I had a lot of guilt about that as well. And so I went to her because I just felt like every day I was walking around with a backpack full of rocks. Like I just couldn't get out from under this heaviness. And it took about 8-9 months of therapy, but we were able to get to a place where I didn't feel like I was constantly walking under the burden of failing at this idea of what a mom should be. So for me, EMDR is super, super beneficial. It can help adults that want to push through any kind of trauma. Like my girlfriend, her brother committed suicide and she found his body. And so for her, she needed to work through that, and that helped her to do that. So And I think one of the things about EMDR is you don't need to have what we call big T trauma in order to access it. There's a lot of like little T trauma, like maybe your mom was sort of emotionally distant growing up. Maybe your dad was, you know, not affectionate. Like there's all these little things that could have negatively impacted you that maybe you just have never processed. So EMDR is good for helping to work through those different types of trauma.
That was really helpful and well explained. So do you utilize that type of therapy and regular therapy, like both?
You totally can. I didn't at the time. I just did the EMDR therapy, and then we ended up moving down here, and I couldn't find another EMDR therapist in our area that took insurance. It's pretty specialized. You know, it's a challenge for a lot of parents, right? It's like, I want help, but finding someone that I like who has the skills to help me and that doesn't cost, you know, $400 an hour, like that's challenging. So I felt that I was in a good enough place though, in terms of having processed a lot of that trauma, to go into more conventional CBT or cognitive behavioral therapy, that sort of approach. So that's the woman that I see now. She's more like a traditional quote unquote therapist. Mm-hmm.
Do you feel like all of these therapies have helped you in your motherhood journey, specifically with your son and his possible or probable neurodivergence?
I absolutely think that they do. And not so much that they helped him as that they helped me with myself. And that was the biggest thing, right? I remember working with a woman who was a social worker and a doula. She ran a parenting group in the Bay Area that was a lifesaver for me after I had my kid. It was like a postpartum support group. And she said, the number one best thing that parents can do is to handle their own garbage, because you're going to give your kid baggage and make mistakes, but handle your own stuff first, so you're not adding that onto it. So for me, therapy helped me, and I'll include my husband in that statement, helped him as well, just deal with a lot of the garbage that we hadn't dealt with from childhood, from teen years, past relationships, whatever, right? It helped us to deal with that, that way we could at least start with a more even surface for our kid.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So I feel like this is kind of like your number one tip. I mean, in some ways for motherhood is therapy for the parents.
I can't think of anything that has worked better. I mean, therapy and it's this other one I'm hesitant to say, because it's not an option or a reality for a lot of moms, but alone time.
Yeah.
For me, that's a huge one, because as you know, when you are parenting a neurodivergent child or children, whether or not you are neurodivergent yourself, you're giving and you're giving and you're giving and you're vigilant and you're watching and you're taking care of, and that drains people's batteries pretty quickly. I mean, some more than others, depending on how your battery is. Mine tends to run a little lower on average, just because of how my brain works. So for me, I have to have periods of time where I'm not looking at my kid, where I'm not watching him, where, you know, and that's where things like preschool and kindergarten have been very beneficial, because if I am with someone all the time, I tend to neglect my own self-care and take care of them more. I'm one of those kind of, you know, codependent caretaker people. So for me, it's been therapy and then finding ways to fill my own cup when I'm by myself.
So true. And I feel the exact same way about alone time, but I also know how hard it is. Let's take a weekend, for example, or like a school vacation, and how hard it is to advocate for yourself, mm-hmm. to say, well, I know my kid is home and he's dysregulated, but I need my time. How do you do that? And, you know, how much time do you take?
For me, usually I just take like an hour, maybe an hour and a half. My husband and I are lucky because we're able to communicate what we need pretty easily to each other. For my husband, you know, his alone self-care looks like going to play golf or hockey. Those are his two sort of, you know, things he does to, you know, fill his own cup. So he'll be like, I'm going to go play golf. And I'll be like, okay, you know, and I'll do whatever with our kid. And then for me, I love to take long walks outside with the dog. So I'm like, I'm going to go walk by the harbor. I'm going to go walk around the lake, whatever, with the dog. And he's like, okay, I've got our son. So for us, it looks like communicating and finding at least an hour where we are away from the other two people in our home. And we're just doing the thing that makes us feel good. Like I'll put on you know, a true crime podcast, and I will just walk around the lake and, you know, think about people being murdered that I don't know. You know, it sounds like a weird thing to rejuvenate, but that's what I enjoy doing. So
hilarious. And there's a lot of true crime podcast fans out there. So it's not just you.
Yeah.
How often do you utilize this alone time? Is this like a daily thing?
I try to make it a daily thing. Yeah, I try to do it. And again, my son is in TK right now. So during the week, I, you know, do that when he's at school, obviously usually in the morning before it gets too warm. And then on the weekends, it's a little harder because he is home and there's activities. There's, you know, he has swimming lesson and he plays baseball and there's play dates and there's kids' birthday parties. And, you know, there's all these types of things sort of take up the time on the weekend. But usually I'm able to find an hour and be like, hey, I'm stepping out for an hour. And my husband will be like, okay, I got it. So yeah, that's what I usually try to do that.
Yeah, I love it. And I think people know that this is important, but are still not prioritizing it because it doesn't feel possible.
Yeah.
But it needs to happen.
It does need to happen. And I think you brought up a good point. Sometimes it feels like, okay, I leave for an hour and then I come back to all the stuff I still have to do. And that can be challenging too, to sort of put, you know, I need to take care of myself, you know, above the laundry and the dishes and this, and all the other things, the errands and what have you. I think also sometimes we can feel obligated to say yes to everything that we're invited to. And sometimes it looks like we would love to go to, you know, Aunt Eunice's, you know, 45th hot dog competition, you know, but we can't, you know, because there's just too much on our plate. So we try to leave gaps in our weekend to just be bored basically, and to just do the little things, you know, in the same space as each other. So we're together, but we're all kind of doing our own thing. Like for my kid, that maybe like, he's just playing Legos over here and I'm doing a puzzle and my husband is, you know, whatever, you know, so like for us finding those spots where, you know, you're together, but you're each doing your kind of preferred activity, basically like grown-up parallel play, you know, like that works for us well too, because we feel like we're together, but we're each doing something that we really enjoy doing.
Mm-hmm. I love that. Love that. And I'm feeling the pressure as my kids are older, you know, 9 and 6. And it's like, are we overbooking ourselves here? I don't like how it feels. Mm-hmm. Even though, that being said, even if we're home on a weekend and there's nothing going on, I'm looking around my house, there's dishes, my house is a disaster, hence why the background is blurred, but Legos everywhere. And the kids took out blankets and there's laundry and there's everything. And I love some quiet crafts. I love to color and I love diamond art and I love reading and I love going for walks and I love sunshine, but I can't get past my mental to-do list. And I guess this doesn't always have to do with neurodivergent kids. This is just motherhood in general, but how do you say, I'm not dealing with that right now. I am going to sit down and do a puzzle.
So that is challenging for me. That is something that I still struggle with. Like I do love my self-care, but like a lot of moms, I often don't put it at the top of my list. I know that I should, but I will often be like, okay, I at least need the space that I'm going to be in to not be cluttery, because that causes me anxiety. So for me, that may look like, okay, I'm just going to keep my living room some kind of way, so I'm not constantly like, oh, I need to vacuum, you know, but maybe I won't think about like the dishes. Yeah. One thing my husband and I started doing is we started divvying up rooms of the house that we're in charge of. So my husband is in charge of the kitchen. He does all the cooking and most of the dishes. Like that is sort of his contribution. I will keep the living room tidy and I help my son. He's still learning how to, you know, kind of put everything away and, you know, that sort of thing. So having those divisions, I can also in my mind be like, well, that's not my responsibility. The kitchen is my husband's responsibility and he will take care of that. So I guess trying to divide up the load as much as you can. And again, that isn't everyone's reality. Some people are single parents or, you know, it's just, they don't always have the help of another person. But if you can divvy it up so that it doesn't feel like keeping this house together is just on me. That's been helpful for me to reduce anxiety.
I love that idea. I love that idea. I want to go downstairs and tell my husband, like, we're divvying up the rooms. Yeah. I think that's such a good idea. And even if you are solo parenting, maybe it could look like, you know, the living room is on Wednesdays. Like, yeah. I know it's a mess, but I'm just not going to touch it until yeah. it's Wednesday.
Yeah.
And creating these categories. And that's something I really struggle with too. Mm-hmm. I am constantly overwhelmed by everything. Yeah. And I have a hard time compartmentalizing, you know, this room or this task is on this day. And I'm thinking about all the things all the time. And that yeah. includes parenting. That includes, is there going to be a meltdown today? Does this dinner work for my kid? You know, what do I need to make sure I put into place so that they have a happy and successful afternoon, evening, weekend? And it's, my brain is constantly going. So is that something that you can relate to at all?
Oh yeah. The racing brain. I don't remember a time when my brain has ever been blank. Like I remember talking to people and like, oh, what are you thinking? Oh, nothing. You're thinking nothing. How are you thinking nothing? Like, how is that possible? Like I've never thought nothing. You know,
same.
Yeah. So just, I'm always, and I think it's part of the reason why I love TV so much, like because TV forces my brain to think about it and not all the other, you know, things sort of around me. Same with reading. I'm a voracious reader. I mean, I taught English for almost 10 years. You know, I love reading because, again, it makes my brain right there instead of, you know, being all over the place. I think it's hard when you have a racing brain and they're like, you know, people say, oh, well, have you tried, you know, mindfulness? Have you tried meditation? It's like, I can't get my brain to sit still for mindfulness and meditation. So if you can help me with the first step, I can take it from there. So I think it also, it's helpful to sort of reframe what, like, and going back to our self-care thing, I think it's also helpful to reframe the idea of self-care needing to look like one thing. It's not always doing meditation while you're sitting in a bubble bath. Like, maybe for you, mindfulness and self-care is making a cake. You know, maybe it's organizing your shoes just because you like organizing your whatever it is. And I think being really flexible and accepting that whatever it is that feels good for you is your version of self-care, even if it doesn't feel or seem like self-care to other people.
I love all of this. And really, my takeaway from this conversation is that you have figured a lot of things out, a lot about you and what you need and how to make sure you get what you need, and how that filters down to helping your son get what he needs. You know, is there anything that you want to say that you want other moms to hear that pertains to anything, that advice or just your thoughts and reflections about being a mom of a neurodivergent kid?
Well, I think one of the most important things, and you've done such an amazing, amazing job with this, is finding a community and finding a space, because it is hard. It is hard when we're taught that, you know, oh, community, you know, just kind of comes naturally when you're a mom. It doesn't just come naturally when you're a mom. And it's even harder when your child is the kid that engages in behaviors that other parents may look at and be like, well, I don't want my kid to play with them. Or there's, you know, no play dates because your child, you know, maybe has behaviors that are sometimes, you know, sort of not popular or, you know, whatever. That can be really hard. And it can make you feel so isolated. And you can feel like, I'm doing something wrong. Something is wrong with my kid. You know, why don't I have a mom tribe? Why don't I have a community? Why doesn't my kid get asked to go on play dates? You know, that sort of thing. That's where I think that finding a community is so important, and you're doing that for everyone. And I think what you're doing is just, it's so, so important, and it's needed. So for moms, I would encourage them to find a community. You know, you can start a meetup group, you know, if you want in your area, if you're like, hey, I want to start a meetup group for parents of neurodivergent kids at the local playground, whatever, right? Like, you can take steps in your own community. If your kid goes to any kind of services, OT, PT, speech, what have you, you know, you can talk to the, you know, owner of whatever therapy center is and be like, hey, I want to start a support group for parents that bring their kids here. What would that look like? You know, that sort of thing. So I think there are ways. And again, these things take time and energy and resources. Not everyone has that. I get it. But if it is something that you're curious about, you know, usually if you build it, they will come, because there is a need, as you have shown with your podcast and your, you know, social media, there is a need for parents to connect.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. First of all, that was kind. And I agree. And it doesn't have to be a big community. Going to the guidance counselor at your kid's school and saying, hey, if you come across any other moms who are struggling, like, I would love to meet up with them. Let me know. We can share emails. It can be something as simple as that. Because the fact of the matter is, we are very large in numbers. And even though it doesn't feel like that, it really doesn't. You feel so lonely, but you're not. I mean, there's moms specifically everywhere who are struggling and looking for the same things. So I appreciate that. Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. I think also, you know, a lot of parents worry about their children being judged or made fun of or being isolated. And that can sometimes prevent parents from wanting to go out in public, you know, depending on the presentation of their child's, you know, needs or disabilities. They may be like, well, you know, no one's going to play with him at the playground, or what if he has a meltdown at the bookstore, whatever it may be. And those fears can get into our own heads, and they can prevent us sometimes from doing things. I'm the first person to admit that there's been a lot of times with Nick where I'm like, I just don't want to go to the place because I don't know what he's going to do. I don't want to have an exit strategy if he has, you know, a meltdown because he can't have his way. And so I think that's another barrier for a lot of moms when it comes to trying to connect.
I agree. And the worry of what other people think and what they're going to see and how they're going to judge your child is overpowering sometimes. And so it literally stops you from going and doing things, or signing your kids up for a sport, or, you know, whatever it is. And so that's where community comes into play too, because if you then connect with another mom who can share that same sentiment, like, hey, let's start up a playgroup. Then there's two of us. Oh, I know this other mom. Great. There's three. Let's meet three, you know, two times a week at the playground for an hour, and slowly building out your own extracurricular activities. If you can't find ones that work, you build them yourself. I agree. I think these are the keys. But like I said, even if you struggle with that, my takeaway here is that you really like have such a good head on your shoulders. Like, you really, you got this, like, you know what you're doing, and it's inspiring. Also, you should be a writer. I don't know if you're a writer, but you should be a writer.
Oh, I'm a failed writer. Yeah, no, I love writing, but with the ADHD, it's hard to focus long enough to like get a book out of me. Like, I have 1,000 ideas. I'm one of those people, but like actually sitting down, you know, I'll sit down to write something and it'll be like, is that a lizard outside? You know, and it's so hard, but I appreciate that. Thank you.
Oh my gosh. Well, you're hilarious. You're very funny. I just really enjoyed this conversation from the standpoint of, you know, this is going to be okay. We got this. We're learning about ourselves, learning about what we need, what we don't need, and how we can help our kid. And we can press on, and it's going to be okay. And that's really the vibe that you give off. And I love that. So thank you so much, Hannah, for sharing all of that.
I appreciate so much. It's been such a pleasure talking with you.
Yes, same.
Thanks for listening today. If you would like to talk with me personally, where we can chat and just get to know each other like old friends, I would love to do a discovery call with you. Go to my website, ontheharddays.com, and click on schedule a call. And if you're not already subscribed to this podcast, please do so that you get the latest when they roll out. Not to mention, please leave a review if you feel like this episode spoke to you. That way, the podcast will be shown to more mothers. And finally, you can find me on Instagram at ontheharddays with dots in between each word, or in my free Facebook community, On the Hard Days Podcast and Community. If you are feeling isolated in your parenting journey, I encourage you to reach out through any of these means so that I can connect you with your people and support you in whatever way you need.